This Star News Media podcast is presented by North Chase Family Dentistry. Open evenings, Saturdays, and they probably take your insurance. Visit them on the web at northchasefamilydentistry.com. And by Tide Water Heating and Air Conditioning, servicing all major brands with highly trained technicians who are the best the industry has to offer, serving Wilmington and surrounding communities for more than 40 years. Learn more at TidewaterAC.com.
And by Cape Fear Pharmacy, a local independent pharmacy providing healthcare and compounding services customized to meet our patients' needs. Visit CapeFearPharmacy.com today and let us take care of you.
Forty-six years after the Confederacy collapsed at the end of the Civil War, the pride many of Wilmington's residents still held for the Southern cause was put on full display on the afternoon of April 20th, 1911. At that point, the war was still lodged in the memories of those old enough to remember the steep price paid by both sides. And on that particular afternoon, many of those residents, some now elderly veterans of the fighting, gathered at the intersection of 3rd and Market Streets for the unveiling of a monument to one of the Confederacy's leading officials in its final years, Attorney General George Davis. In the Wilmington Morning Star the following day, a lengthy article called the ceremony profound, impressive, and as the paper puts it, could not be more fitting or more in keeping the honor and reverence in which the memory of Mr. Davis is held. A choir filled the stands that lined Market Street, serenading the proceedings and a parade of military men. Residents stood on the street and claimed what few seats weren't occupied by veterans and political officials from across the state, all beaming with excitement to honor a man known as a great lawyer, public speaker, and quote-unquote, distinguished son of Wilmington. However, no mention was made of Davis's support of slavery at a crucial moment in the days before North Carolina seceded from the Union. The same fervor of Southern devotion was seen again 13 years later, in 1924, when the memorial statue to those New Hanover County residents who fought for the Confederates' cause was unveiled to large crowds just a block away at 3rd and Dock Streets. Each statue was erected with a promise to offer eternal glory and prominent recognition to the sacrifice and courage of the Confederacy, which came to greatly rely on Wilmington's port and its people by the end of the war. But just a few weeks ago, both statues, which had been unveiled in full view of the entire city, were removed from their century-old perches in the dark of night with no crowds or parades. For some, it was a long time coming, and well overdue after years of public outcry. But for others, it was an attack on the very heritage of Southern identity that the monuments stood for. Their removal comes as the country continues to reckon with the darker chapters of its history. Protesters have staked their ground in cities big and small, demanding the protection of black citizens in a country that was inarguably founded on an institution that valued them as less. But 160 years after the war between the states, how much does either side of this current conversation actually know about the monuments they're rallying to save or topple? Who was George Davis? What was the mission of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, who were responsible for erecting both monuments? And how, over the course of a century, did these once celebrated pillars to the past become, for some, embodiments of this country's racial inequality? This is Cape Fear Unearthed, the podcast exploring the persisting legends, historical oddities, and landmark stories of southeastern North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Hunter Ingram, and I'm a reporter with the Star News here in Wilmington. This week on the show, we're going to tackle one of the most talked about topics in our country right now, the future of Confederate monuments. As I previously mentioned, two publicly displayed statues to the Confederacy in downtown Wilmington were removed overnight on June 25th after weeks and honestly years of calls for them to come down. Now, no matter how you feel about the monuments, it is each of our duties to know the history of the issues on which we take a stand. Too often, judgments are made and opinions are shouted in the comment sections about topics that people just haven't done their homework on. So we're going to offer some help. In this episode, I'm going to share the story of George Davis. Who was he? What did he believe? And why did his influential place in the high command of the Confederacy deem him worthy of a monument at a defining moment in Wilmington's history? Then, I'll briefly share with you the history of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, the group that secured Davis's monument and the Confederate monument a block away. What role did they play in the post-war society? And what were their intentions behind the monuments? History is at the forefront of our national conversation in such a major way right now. So let's talk about it. This week, we won't have a guest. It's just going to be me, giving you some context for these monuments and their stories, so that you can determine where you stand on this moment in history. So sit back and settle in for this episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, as we talk about the history behind the Confederate monuments of downtown Wilmington. The 1911 Wilmington Morning Star article that recounted the George Davis Monument Ceremony was titled, "All Wilmington Honors Mr. Davis." Now, that headline is perhaps wildly dismissive of how other segments of the community likely perceived the recognition that Davis was receiving. After all, this came just 13 years after the 1898 Wilmington Massacre, a truly reprehensible event that saw a mob of white supremacists burn a black-run newspaper, before killing an untold number of black citizens and actively working to run those that escaped the violence out of town. Then, they seized the city's seat of power for themselves. It's this country's only successful coup d'etat, and it drastically changed the makeup and culture of Wilmington. It was events like this that emboldened the Confederacy's still staunch supporters to push for it to be recognized with monuments, such as the one to Davis, in such a prominent location in the city. The motive behind those monuments is something that we're going to talk about a little later. But before we get there, let's talk about who they were honoring. George Davis was the kind of deep-rooted Southerner who could trace his lineage directly to the development of the Cape Fear. His ancestor was John Yeamans, the man behind the first attempt to colonize southeastern North Carolina with the doomed Charlestown settlement on Town Creek in 1664. The names inscribed on the branches of his family tree put Davis in the upper crust of Cape Fear society, which pretty much had a hand in every facet of this region. Davis was born in the Porter's Neck area on his father's plantation in March 1820. He had a typical childhood for someone born into a family of means, having been prepared for higher education by a tutor before entering the University of North Carolina at age 14. After graduating, he immediately set forth on a lauded career as a lawyer, excelling early and being admitted to the bar at just 20 years old. His first office was in Wilmington, where it said that he never bound himself to one specialty. That versatility would make him ideal for the challenges ahead for the Confederacy. In telling Davis's story throughout this episode, I'm going to use several direct quotes from people who wrote about or spoke about him around the time of the monument's installation. I want to let their words speak to his character and illustrate the intense admiration still held for him even into the mid-20th century. In the October 1946 edition of the North Carolina Historical Review, an article about Davis's legacy gives us an idea of his family's role in Wilmington society and their ironclad grip on Southern ideals. Quote, "The Davis family was long noted for its culture, political leadership, and religious devotion. It was a family of big planters, numerous slaves, and much wealth." End quote. Well aware of his connections to the founding families of the region, Davis would spin off his legal career into giving impassioned speeches about the establishment of the Cape Fear. These historical oratories were considered, for a time, worthy additions to the area's historical arsenal, as he primarily sought to correct falsehoods and inaccuracies he found in early accounts of the region. During his time, critics wrote favorably about Davis's speeches, which were said to be filled with humor, wit, and a dramatic, almost high art form of delivery that captivated his audiences. It was those talents for spinning a well-delivered argument that earned him the often-used description of eloquent. It's a word that recurs in nearly every account of his life and articles of his achievements. And it's even inscribed on the base of his monument. Noted historian James Sprunt gives a full-throated endorsement of Davis's speaking abilities in his often referenced text, Chronicles of the Cape Fear River, in which he uses the word eloquent repeatedly. But no matter how many grand speeches he extolled about the virtues of the Cape Fear, George Davis's legacy will always be defined by his service to the Confederacy. He was a bit of a nomad politically, in a time when the shifting sands of politics were a minefield of allegiances. But really, when aren't they? He was a devoted Whig until the collapse of the party, and he actually fought against secession after Abraham Lincoln was elected president in 1860. Instead, he advised that North Carolina should exhaust all possible remedies to keep the Union intact. But his role as a state delegate to the Washington Peace Conference in January 1861 did nothing to bolster his dream of a perfect Union. After returning from the conference, it became pretty clear that he was particularly steadfast when it came to owning slaves. His family had long done this in the cultivation of their wealth and status, and he believed it was a non-negotiable right for the people of North Carolina. Eventually, it was because of this issue that he would abandon all hopes of a compromise and openly advocate for secession. In a speech at Thalian Hall on March 2, 1861, in which a large crowd hung on every word of his debrief from Washington, the Daily Record reported him as saying, quote, "The division must be made on the line of slavery. The South must go with the South, and not with any newfangled central republic or as the tail end and victim of the free soil North." End quote. Even before the first shots had been fired, Davis, along with many others in Wilmington, were already digging in their heels to protect the institution of slavery. It wasn't just states' rights that had turned this man, who initially defied his neighbors in advocating to save the Union. It was the threat of abolishing slavery that changed his mind. As the war got underway, Davis would catch the eye of the ever-changing leadership at the top of the Confederate government. He would initially resist being involved in the governing process of the newly separated South, but he gave in by September 1861 when he was elected a senator in the Confederate Congress, where he would serve until he lost re-election in 1863. But by then, the close relationships he'd forged with those in power, including Confederate President Jefferson Davis, were already solidified. By January 1864, he had been appointed Attorney General, becoming the fourth man to hold the title in less than 3 years. As the chief lawyer in the South, he would have the largest jurisdiction of his career. But he was also a close advisor of the South's president, who, by 1864, was starting to feel the pressure of the crumbling Confederate effort. Davis would remain Attorney General until his friend and commander-in-chief advised him to resign in April 1865, when it was clear the South's fight was now a lost cause. He gave the Confederate leader one final bit of advice: to accept surrender and try to preserve as much funding for the South's soldiers as possible. Then, he tried to flee the country, making it as far as Florida before he was caught and brought back as a prisoner to Fort Hamilton in New York. He was freed in January 1866, at which point he returned home to Wilmington. After the war, Davis would transition back to the life of a small-town lawyer, but his jobs got bigger. He was the general counsel for the Wilmington Weldon Railroad, and later the Atlantic Coastline Railroad. He would also serve as director of the Bank of Wilmington, and was even offered the position of Chief Justice of the State in 1878 by then-Governor Zebulon B. Vance. But he turned down the offer. Davis died in 1896, the father of six, from two marriages. Less than a decade later, the United Daughters of the Confederacy had already deemed him their candidate for a monument by 1904. They started out by putting $50 in the George Davis Memorial Fund, and more small donations would follow. But they struggled to find widespread support for their effort. It wasn't until Sprunt and his local influence came along that they were able to raise the remaining $5,000 or so dollars so they could move forward with the project. At the unveiling ceremony in 1911, Judge Henry G. Connor gave the address officially accepting the monument as one of the city's quote-unquote most prized possessions. In his speech about the statue, he did all but explicitly accept Davis's views as gospel. But then again, he didn't really need to explicitly state it, because most of those in the crowd already knew and likely shared the beliefs of the man immortalized in bronze on the pedestal. Quote, "The monument commemorates the virtues of one of our own fellow citizens, who, through a long life as a great lawyer, never bowed a knee to Baal, never lowered the standard of right, never stood for anything which his conscience did not approve." End quote. Despite all of this acclaim for Davis's work, and even a statue to his memory, few people could probably tell you his story outside of the historical community today. That deterioration of his place in the public consciousness had already begun by the time Sprunt was writing his book. Pulling from the inscription engraved on the monument, Sprunt wrote, quote, Would that the youth of the rising generation, who daily pass the bronze effigy of this foremost scholar and statesman of the Cape Fear, knew more of one whose wisdom truly illustrates the principles of law and equity, whose eloquence commanded the admiration of his peers, who was beloved for his stainless integrity. End quote. But even if Davis's contributions have largely been expunged from popular accounts of the Cape Fear, the United Daughters of the Confederacy have made sure that he and his commitment to the ideals of the South, including the Confederacy, were never far out of sight from anyone who visited downtown Wilmington. That was the role of the UDC in those final years of the 1800s and into the dawn of the 20th century. As the final veterans of the war were dying off, they had vowed to not let the Confederacy's legacy die with them. The UDC was officially formed in Nashville, Tennessee, in September 1894, from a collective of hospital associations, sewing societies, and knitting circles, whose members worked to supply soldiers with clothes and goods during the war. After the war, the women's groups turned their attention to memorial efforts, as the South began to assess its loss and remember its many husbands and sons, most without bodies to bury. They worked to offer assistance to widows and children of those who died, and sought to better share the stories of women and their role in the war. It was under this mission of remembrance and preservation that the UDC was born. But the organization has long been charged with focusing on furthering its own narrative of Confederate culture, specifically bolstering a movement known as the Lost Cause. This effort was a widespread attempt after the war to frame the Confederacy's cause as heroic and not due to its advocacy for slavery. But as you heard earlier, George Davis explicitly said that slavery was the root issue on which he based his endorsement of secession in 1861. Even on its website today, the UDC says that one of its pillars is to, quote, collect and preserve the materials for a truthful history of the war between the states, end quote. For decades, the UDC worked in loud and subtle ways to ensure that Confederate culture retained its foothold in the South, knowing full well that if they were the ones telling the story, they could shape the narrative. Under the work of these women, the Confederacy's memory was not one of defeat, but one of victory, because that way of life that they held so dear was able to survive in the South, despite losing the war. A core tenet of the UDC was influencing history at the root, in education, by publishing children's books and pushing textbooks that intentionally reframed the Confederacy's history by watering down the horrors and realities of slavery and attacking any other textbooks that they thought unjustly characterized the Confederacy's mission. They also formed the Children of the Confederacy, a program that indoctrinated children of the South into this reframing of the Confederacy at a young age, through songs, activities, and events. If the UDC wanted to immortalize the South's culture long after they were gone, they needed to recruit the next generation while they were still impressionable. Those years of having a hand in the school books of children across the South undoubtedly had a trickle-down effect on the generations that followed, many of whom would lead the fight against integration in the 1950s and 60s. The United Daughters of the Confederacy Cape Fear Chapter 3, which is still operational today, also founded what is now the Cape Fear Museum in March 1898. They opened it in just one room of the Wilmington Light Infantry Building on Market Street, just a block from where Davis's statue would be placed. Later that year, that building would become the meeting ground for the mob of white supremacists who led the Wilmington coup. The UDC's goal with the museum was simple: collect and preserve the Confederacy's legacy through artifacts and the accounts of local residents. They shipped much of their collection to Raleigh during World War I, as their influence waned. But they helped get it back before handing the museum off in the 1930s. Today, the county-operated Cape Fear Museum works to preserve all facets of local history. But the UDC's most noticeable effort came in the establishment of monuments. In their own communities, these women used their local influence to secure prominent public locations for hundreds of imposing statues to notable figures from the Confederacy and general memorials to the dead. This mainly happened in the first quarter of the 1900s, when there was a sense of urgency to commemorate the Confederacy before the veterans who remembered the fighting died off and the era of a living history of the war went with them. At that time, the UDC was asking how these next generations would remember them. The George Davis Monument was the local UDC's first major attempt at answering that question in downtown Wilmington, followed closely by the Confederate Memorial at 3rd and Dock Streets. The latter bronze statue features a tall soldier gripping a rifle and standing defiantly as another soldier falls at his feet. According to the statue's intention, these two men represent the courage and sacrifice shown by the Confederate soldiers of the region. The monument was designed by Henry Bacon, a Wilmington native who was best known as the designer of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. This monument, however, was finished after his death in 1924. The UDC worked with the Confederate Veterans Association to secure the statue, which was funded by the will of Gabriel James Boney, a veteran of the war. At the dedication ceremony on November 6, 1924, Boney's granddaughter unveiled the statue, which had been draped in Confederate battle flags, as was the tradition for those types of events. However, the ceremony did sidestep tradition in one way. It said that the Star Spangled Banner was played as the statue was unveiled, not Dixie, which was the defining song of the South. In those days, the UDC's Cape Fear chapter was also involved in other monuments and memorials, including the Rose Greenhow grave at Oakdale Cemetery and the Battle Acre Monument at Fort Fisher. So you may be asking yourself, what does all this mean in 2020? How do the memories of George Davis and the Confederate soldiers that died a century and a half ago affect Wilmington today? Well, that depends on who you ask. If you talk to a supporter of the monuments, you're likely to hear them speak about how they are part of history, and removing them is a slippery slope to erasing more facets of our past. Recent comments online have claimed that the statues are merely vestiges of the past, marking the region's contribution to what was the defining moment of the 19th century in America. And some of those in the historical community say that removing them gets rid of even the opportunity to educate the public about those represented, the good and the bad. But those who sought to see them removed say there are plenty of opportunities for that kind of education elsewhere, like in books, museums, or at one of the area's historic sites. This side of the conversation, which advocated for the monuments to be moved to more appropriate locations, took issue with the presence of such grand displays that could be seen as supporting the Confederate cause, right in the heart of the historic district. But for many in the community, especially those in the Black community, these monuments will always be seen as glorifications of the fight to protect slavery. Regardless of what might be said, slavery was an undeniable factor in the Civil War, for both sides, and the monuments in Wilmington and throughout the South are pillars to that time, but they often lack the breadth of context for their stories. In the case of Davis's statue, it selectively includes his accolades and words of praise, but makes no mention of his support of slavery, which many people believe is a rather important thing to know about someone's ideology, especially if they're on a statue in the middle of town. Historians say that monuments like those in downtown Wilmington were installed to reassert a false sense of supremacy for white people in the South, and in turn, cruelly intimidate people of color. At a time when Jim Crow laws dominated the country, and race relations in Wilmington were still frayed after the 1898 coup. We'll never know what conversations were truly had in those local UDC planning meetings to understand why these women wanted these statues. But you have to admit that seeing such a prominent display erected for a supporter of slavery and an advocate for disbanding America to protect it was never going to unify a city in desperate need of moving forward together. It is not yet known what's going to happen to the monuments removed from downtown Wilmington, though, as of July 2020, their pedestals still remain. They could go to a museum or be taken to a historic site. They could be housed away in storage or placed in a cemetery next to Confederate graves. It's even possible that they'll be returned to the places they've stood for a century, but that seems unlikely. Whatever their future, these statues have come a long way from those jovial ceremonies when they were unveiled to adoring crowds, during a time when intense political divides and persistent racial inequality were open wounds for this city and this country. These monuments did nothing to heal them, and looking at the current state of our union, they are still issues we have yet to solve. That's it for this episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, and our look at the history of downtown Wilmington's Confederate monuments. Thank you so much for joining me. Be sure to check back soon for our next episode, when we will turn to another chapter in our local history book. Until then, make sure that you're a member of our Facebook group, where listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their own memories of the region's history. In that group, I post extra content for each of our episodes, and all of my local history coverage for the Star News. You can find that group by searching Cape Fear Unearthed on Facebook. If you have episode ideas or questions about the show, you can also email me directly at capefearunearthed@gmail.com. And don't forget to sign up for the Cape Fear Unearthed newsletter, which goes out every week. In it, I include links to all of our new episodes and any supplemental pictures or videos that I uncover in my research, all delivered right to your inbox. Sign up for that newsletter at starnewsonline.com/newsletters. As always, you can get a list of all the books, articles, and resources used in researching this podcast in the show notes of each episode. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by me, Hunter Ingram. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com or by following me on Twitter at Hunter_Wesley. Additional editing is done by Adam Fish. This podcast is made possible by listeners and readers like you. Support local journalism and Cape Fear Unearthed by subscribing to the Star News today at starnewsonline.com/subscribe. And while you're subscribing to things, be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there, leave us a review, which will help more people find Cape Fear Unearthed. Until next time, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. You never know what you might unearth.